Hi, my name is Carmen Murray and I'm the founder of Conscious Leaders, and very excited to share with you the webinar series that we recently launched on ESG, the good, the bad and the ugly of ESG. As you possibly know, is since the pandemic, there's been a major shift towards ESG and paying more attention to that, and so should we. And we really wanted to have conversations around what is the Sustainable Development Goals, what is ESG, why do we need to pay attention, what is happening, and really bring the conversation from boardroom to living room. What we have found is that ESG is very much a conversation that is happening in corporates and in government and in external environment. But how do we bring it as a conversation back to who we are as consumers, who we are as people and communities, and understanding what's happening at grassroots levels? Because ultimately, sustainability impacts all of us, and to preserve this planet and to create a better and fortified future for all of us, we need to start looking at what is our impact. Responsible consumerism, how do we use our voting power to ensure that what we buy is actually ethical and what we engage with is ethical? We need to start asking a lot more deeper questions, and we really just wanted to bring the two worlds together so we can learn from it, and bringing in special guests. And I couldn't have done this without the remarkable and incredible Kalnisha Singh, who's a developmental economist who works with sustainability all day long, works on projects on grassroots levels, and works with corporates to bring these big projects to life, and really understanding what this world is all about. And then the remarkable guests, that really brings different perspectives to the conversation, from trust and how do we build trust, how do we bring trust back, why the language needs to change in order for the system to change, and what really happens with sustainability on the grassroots level. So this is a continuous journey that we will be having, and we will be sharing the conversations that we're having on the webinar series, on the podcast, so that these conversations can extend beyond borders. But I have to also mention that the conversations really come to life because of the stakeholders and the audiences that are sitting in the actual conversations and steers the conversation. So we implore you to please, as we continue with the ESG webinar series, to please have your voice heard, please be in the room so we can shape that narrative and have the conversations that really needs to happen. Now, over to the ESG webinar series.
Hello. Okay, can everybody hear me okay? Can you hear me okay, Kalnisha?
Yeah, loud and clear.
Fantastic. First of all, to those of you that have managed to find a time this morning to join us, we are super excited that you are here. This is only the beginning of a wonderful ESG webinar series that we have planned, and we are thrilled that we can share this platform with you and all the wisdom and knowledge that comes along with it. So without further ado, I would like to introduce you to a friend, an amazing woman, and so passionate about sustainability. I'm very passionate about marketing, and I've been feeling so ashamed being a marketer, looking at what's going on in the world. And I met with Kalnisha, and it was just like love at first sight. Like, we had the same vision, same ideas, just from different expertise. And we brought our worlds together. And this is why we're bringing this webinar series, because I believe together, bringing our expertise, we can share so much knowledge and wisdom. And we've taken on a theme which is quite hardcore, which is about trust and building a fortified future, and bringing back trust, because the only way to build a resilient future is by building trust. So, Kalnisha, without further ado, welcome, and tell us, how are you feeling?
I'm so excited to be having this conversation this morning. I think it's the perfect time of year to start this kind of, reflective, interesting, depths of conversation. And I'm really excited to see how it all pans out. So yeah, that's where I am. I'm excited to see the audience members, and hear what they're maybe thinking and where they want to take the conversations.
Absolutely. To our audiences, we just ask you to please just put it, in the comment section if there's anything that you feel that we should be addressing or topics. As you can see, there's very, very interesting webinars coming up. We've got Faith Popcorn. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Faith Popcorn, but she is one of the world's most renowned futurists. 95% accuracy rate, and the future that she's predicting scares the crap out of me. So she's gonna join with Bronwyn Williams. But yeah, we'll be talking about that. But I think we want to get to opening up this ESG curtain, right, Kalnisha? And as I said to you from the word go, is I have a lot to learn about ESG, the sustainability and everything that goes on. And I think you and I had a very interesting conversation a while ago when we were saying it feels as if when you talk to people in corporate, and we have to talk the truth here and the lies and the drama and everything that goes on. And I don't think it's from intent, but people are so busy being busy. And I always think that being too busy makes is creates making us more dumber as a society. And I hate to say it in such a blunt way, but I think what's happening as well is that we are seeing so many people that are disconnected of what's going on at grassroots levels. And that we need to talk about because it's like two worlds that need to connect. And how do we actually unpack this ESG? Maybe you can take it from there.
So, I mean, it's a really interesting point that you raised, right? But I mean, before we get into the intricacies of it, let's talk a little bit about the evolution of ESG and where we find ourselves. So ESG, as everyone knows, and it's probably the reason everybody's in the room, is this very new topical concept that is being thrown around in industry in the world of business. And it's like an additional layer of compliance that companies need to meet or address for whatever reason. And it's been treated a lot. I mean, it's been treated like a new thing. We see a lot of traction, particularly post-COVID, with more people having the conversations, more companies looking for consultants, and that sort of thing. But I mean, where we find ourselves is essentially a sort of culmination of the sustainability movement that started probably, in the mid-1980s. So since the 1980s, we've been thinking about collectively as a global society about how we shift business models, right? Because business models are fundamentally extractive and exploitative, especially if you look at historically. I mean, people had no trouble back in the day, engaging in the slave trade. In order to make, some money. They had no trouble exploiting, child labor in order to make some money. And it was sort of, as we saw the building of these industrial sort of behemoths, we also saw the exploitation of human rights, we saw the exploitation of environmental systems. And while business has evolved to not be so obviously exploitative anymore, those exploitative extractive foundations still fundamentally exist in most business models. So around the 1980s, scholars and academics and activists started thinking about how do we do business better? How do we weigh up the sort of opposing forces of making a profit and also taking care of environmental well-being and also taking care of societal well-being? Not exploiting humans, not exploiting nature, not exploiting natural resources in the quest for making profits. And that was essentially the thinking. The thinking was supposed to be revolutionary. It was supposed to change how we did business. But what we have seen has happened over, the decades that have passed, is that these concepts have sort of just been tacked on, like makeup. To general business practices. We haven't seen a fundamental shift in how people do business. We've just seen the sort of adding on the makeup layers and, the clothes and the fashion and stuff to present it in a pretty package. And that's the sort of tension we're feeling right now. And I don't know if everybody's feeling this tension, but definitely from an economic perspective, that's the tension we're feeling. We're like, we can't add any more makeup. It's going to start looking cakey and fake. So what do we do? What do we actually do now? And it's becoming about peeling off the layers and acknowledging like what's the base, what's the foundation, and starting to rebuild from there.
I absolutely love that. You know, I almost feel all of these faux transformations, like we have seen transformations, but some of them feel to me as an outsider, I sometimes look at them as tick box exercises. I don't feel that they are done at the capacity that that we can. And, you know, I'm talking from a perspective also from being an ethnographer. So just to give the audience a little bit of an insight, being an ethnographer is like being the Sherlock Holmes of the internet and watching human behavior. Now, I'm also a numerologist, so I combine my understanding of numbers and understanding people's names and how they interact with the world, and then understanding their behavior. I start looking at like all of these millions of breadcrumbs and then see what are the patterns that are forming. And what I've realized as I was going down this rabbit hole for over a year, and I think this is where Conscious Leaders was born for me, is the spiritual awakening that is happening. And the spiritual awakening that is happening, especially with women, and I'm going to raise my hand, women going through menopause or women reaching midlife crisis. Now, this is why I called it Fortified Future, because the world must be afraid of a woman that's going through midlife because she is rising like a phoenix from the ashes, and she's becoming strong and fortified. And the things that was okay in the past is no longer okay in this future. And it's now about preserving a future for future generations. I think if we look at Jane Goodall, she said something so powerful once that I really loved. And then she said, so, you know, this future that we're creating, people have become, we're so smart, we can go to the moon, but we've lost so much knowledge and wisdom. It's all about this greed economy, about deadlines for the next 3 months. How much money are we going to make? And, you know, how much are we going to take out of the earth? But we are not talking about a 100-year plan. We are not talking about the indigenous people are brilliant at this. And she said, Jane Goodall said it so well, is that we have lost the knowledge and the wisdom of the indigenous people. And when they make decisions, they are not making decisions just for now. They are making decisions for all the future generations to come. And I think this is the way that tension is starting, right?
No, definitely. And I think, you know, and I hate to bring the sort of conversation back to the things we struggle with specifically in like the global south, right? Colonization created for us the sort of disconnect and this embedded trauma in our pasts. And it's traumatic bonds that we haven't been able to break as much as we, you know, choose to not discuss those bonds. And I think from a global south perspective, the trauma bond that we continue to experience, especially from an economic kind of framing, is that it's this general perception of, you know, what goes on in the global north, in the West, in America, in the UK, it's better than what's going on here. And we see this from a social media perspective, and that's where the greed aspiration comes from, where it's a very consumerist culture. And as we move progressively towards, you know, that sort of light, we tend to forget our own connections to our family and our earth. And I say that intentionally because the sort of 100-year planning is not a new message, especially for Indigenous families, especially for Eastern or families that come from the East and India and Eastern societies and global South traditions. Because it's very normal for you to plan for yourself, for your children, and for your grandchildren. And that's essentially a 100-year plan, right? From Indigenous practices, traditionally in the Global South, you'll sort of acquire land through through marriage and through other forms of partnership, and you're acquiring this land not so that you can reap the benefits, but so that the communal grandchildren can reap the benefits in 100 years' time. And it's those practices that have been severed. And then we have to ask ourselves, why were they severed, and who did it serve to sever those practices? Mm. And we need to look at our conditioning and how we've been conditioned away from what is intrinsic in our families, in our lifestyles, in our bloodlines, essentially. And it starts sounding like a very, very psychological deep conversation. But if we look at pure economic theory from the beginning of capitalism, a lot of this design, a lot of the social design is very, very intentional. And it's that stuff we need to start reworking if we want to talk about sustainability and ESG and really embedding a fortified future for the next generations, because we need to untangle all of that mess of a web in our own minds, in our own families, but also at a societal and economic level.
I love what you're saying there. And also, you know, I mean, obviously the future webinar series that is coming up, where we're going to talk a lot about what the future is not predicting. It's very scary. You know, people having intimate relationships with robots and how we're going to become more and more artificial. You know, I also just have to point out before I want to just want to write down that I don't forget what you just said. Because I think it's a very important point. But if we look, for example, at generative AI, right? The whole world is getting all excited about it. And now, you know, information is democratized like never before. You know, in Johannes Gutenberg, when the printing press was created, we thought, oh my goodness, this is great. But now there's too much information. Now people are going, I'm no longer seeking information, I'm seeking wisdom. And now we are starting to see how people are going inward, where people are like, I have the wisdom inside. I can't control what's going on in the world. It's a world of war. It is everybody's fighting. There's so much toxicity out there. And it's in the workplaces, we have so much toxicity. I can't control what's going on in the world. I want to downsize. I want a minimalist life. I don't want to earn so much money. You know, there's also a lot of questions happening about money. What is the future of money looking like, which we're going to unpack. But I think just to bring this, tie this all together, I think because people are seeking wisdom, I think that organizations need to become wiser. And also understand that wisdom is experience, and wisdom is pattern recognition. And we need to start looking at how we can impart wisdom to the greater picture. Because, you know, one thing I always say, we need spiritual intelligence to become critical thinkers. And people go, ooh, spiritual intelligence, now we're talking woo-woo. It's not necessarily woo-woo. Spiritual intelligence is understanding that everything is interconnected. Everything. And once we can start understanding everything is interconnected, then we can start, you know, looking at profits, and we can start looking at purpose and purpose of human race. What is your view on that?
It's so interesting. I think generative AI is a wonderful thing because the opportunity that it provides us is it can replace the distraction. So you and I, we're all very, very distracted every day by our work and our admin and the sort of transactional aspects of life, right? And generative AI now provides us with that opportunity of creating our own little virtual clones to take care of those transactional aspects while we focus on what's really important, right? And then what is really important? And I think like the focus on wisdom is so profound, especially for us, especially for those of us living in Africa, right, which is said to be the cradle of humankind. And at the same time, we are losing indigenous knowledge at a pace of knots. There's so much wisdom in the elders that has never been documented, that can never be found, you know, on papyrus or in a book or on the internet. And that wisdom is being lost. As you know, the older community, all the members of the community are obviously getting sick and ill and dying, And those messages and those stories and that wisdom has never been passed on, right? So especially, and we started to feel that crisis, obviously during COVID, where a large population of elders died as a result of COVID on this continent. Right. Mm-hmm. So, and it's not just us in Africa, it's the global South generally. You think about anywhere that has insufficient public healthcare systems, has suffered a humongous human tragedy in terms of the loss of lives and the loss of wisdom, 2020, 2021, 2022, right? So we know that we're emerging into this new space from a wisdom deficit already.
Yeah.
So the question is, what are we doing to solve for that deficit? Right. And in that solution, those of us that are working in development economics on the side of the equator really feel that the solutions to some of our economic challenges lie in the truths that will be uncovered. Because if we look at global movements towards how we're dealing with food and how we're dealing with wellness and how we're dealing with work, you know, concepts of work, we are moving back towards traditional practices that were never acknowledged in the formal economic sense. And they were never acknowledged because they were never understood. And I mean, if you hear around, I mean, the conversations around economics in South Africa for the last few years has been around township economics and, you know, formalizing the informal economy. So the very fact that township economics exists as a catchphrase means that there's economic activity in townships that's never been understood by the traditional mainstream economy.
Yeah. So
if you look at a township as a sort of, I want to say, like a concentrated microcosm of a greater sort of African economy or an emerging market economy. These economic mechanisms exist everywhere. They're just not acknowledged by the traditional Western or global North concepts of what economy is.
From my perspective, I also believe that you know, there was this beautiful documentary. If you do have a chance, audience, please do have a look at this incredible documentary. It's The Last Matriarch Society. I think it's in Orango. And it's this beautiful documentary of how the indigenous people live together in Africa and how they have really put everything together, how they run their society, the economy, how they do all of these incredible, amazing things. For example, cooking together and sharing knowledge and wisdom and doing all of this amazing stuff. And one of the things that is really interesting for me about that is that there's this huge concern about Westernization taking over and the younger generation within the indigenous tribes. They don't want to live there. They want to go out into the modern world. And that also ties into something else that I've learned quite recently was like Google, I think was Google Alphabet, where they are trying to preserve all of the languages. Now, as you know, Africa has over 1,000 languages. And because people are no longer speaking about these languages and you know, using it day to day, there's a part where these languages are starting to lose its flair. So if we're losing the language, you know, what is this really going to mean for us in the future? If everything is going to be augmented in the future, are we going to still use our handwritings? Are we still going to write with our hands? Are we going to lose the power of our words in the future? And something very powerful that we will be addressing in a future webinar is this whole sense of, in order for the system to change, the language needs to change. Because now what artificial intelligence is going to bring us is this regurgitation of words and words and words, and maybe it's going to become more and more and more intelligent. But if we're moving into a time where people no longer want information, they want wisdom. It's no longer going to be about the words that you speak. It is now going to be about your action, but it is also going to be about how you make people feel. So how those words come to life is also going to be about how you make people feel. So let me just see if Kalnisha is here with me. Kalnisha, let me just try and see if I can make you a presenter and see if that works. Hi, Kalnisha, can you unmute yourself? Ah, there you are.
Yay!
Listen, I was panicking. I'm like, oh my gosh, I need my partner in crime. Okay, so while you were gone, we were talking about the thing we talked about the other day about the indigenous tribes, Orango, and globalization and westernization, how that is impacting and how we're losing these indigenous tribes. What is your perspective on that?
So I think the great travesty, and it's not so much about the great travesty is that in the pursuit of profit, you know, for the longest time, we've sort of dehumanized people. We've dehumanized largely indigenous people so that we could, you know, literally stop caring about human impact in the pursuit of these profits. And I mean, still to this day, mining companies relocate communities almost every day. And we relocate communities when we're building large scale infrastructure projects. I mean, there's a dam project in one of our very close neighbors that's going to be relocating 300 villages in order to create a dam. So if it's 300 villages, it's, you know, it's a lot of people that are going to be relocated. And what happens in that process of you know, dehumanizing people and moving them and in the pursuit of profits. And we don't say it's in the pursuit of profits, right? We say that it's in the pursuit of development, which is a very, very big misnomer. And we know that what's happened in our families as well is that the idea of going to university and earning a degree and getting a professional job has always been elevated as opposed to doing sort of traditional work, which is running a farm and growing food and things like that. And what happens now? Like, we have a global food security crisis because there aren't enough people growing food. We've always managed to, as a global South society, we've managed to embed ambition in ourselves and in our families that is fundamentally not necessarily good for us. So we take great pride in the fact that we're so busy. We take great pride in the fact that we're working 12-hour days, that we're deprioritizing ourselves in the pursuit of our own financial success, our own wealth creation, right? And is that really how it's supposed to be? And I think the eradication of indigenous tribes has largely been because what they represent, and even like from the days of Christopher Columbus, right? What they represent is a level of knowledge and wisdom and connection with the land and their own purpose that is frightening for people that see the world differently or that have been programmed to see the world differently. So instead of acknowledging and respecting somebody that has fundamental respect for the earth and themselves and their families, we subordinate them in order to elevate somebody that has the greatest respect for their queen and their flag and, you know, gold coins.
Love that. You know, you're touching on something so interesting. So I get so excited when you talk, you know, like every time I go, so what'd you say? But I read something very interesting. If you look at and we can, that's why I say learning from nature is so important and seeing that everything is interconnected. If you look at queen bees, right? Nobody decides the queen bee, like, you know, she's not born in a special way. It is the whole community of bees that decide that there's this special, they call it the royal gel that they inject in the egg of the egg that they decide is going to give birth to the queen. And that is how the queen is actually born in this hive. And it's because the community decides. And I think sometimes when I look at what the world is doing, is maybe the CEO needs to be, you know, voted by the culture and voted by the consumer, you know, to see where businesses are going and how they are creating sustainability. You know, I wanted to go back to the conversation that we were having before you hopped off for a moment. You went to a different channel. but what for me is fascinating, what we're also starting to see is a lot of ethical whistleblowers. So organizations where people, especially in the tech industry, in the world of wars, you know, not the capitalist system and the surveillance capitalism and how people are being monitored and how they have no privacy and how they're being controlled. There's also, you know, generative AI is great, but there's also a downside to it. Because of generative AI, we have a data center boom, and these data centers are not so sustainable. Not yet. And if we then also look on top of that, data centers, they have to put more and more data centers up in order to accommodate all of the data that's generated on a daily basis from all this technology. Then if we put another layer on top of that, what about, like, you just went offline, but a month ago, 9 cables under the ocean was damaged. Our internet resides underneath the ocean. Earthquakes, volcanoes, climate change, all of these things that's going to happen is going to, what if that moment comes where it's going to be a world offline, maybe 3 or 4 days? We're going to need data centers on the moon. There's so much restructuring that needs to happen for this modern world that we are creating. But the thing that I battle to see is we have all the technology in the world, yet we are more busier than ever. It doesn't actually make sense to me. So maybe you can make me see the picture better.
So, I mean, the question is, like, are we busy or are we just distracted?
True.
Right. Because, I mean, that's what I feel. And we always reflect on. I mean, I work a lot with small startups and entrepreneurs, and there's a stat that brings around, and I'm not sure where it comes from, that, you know, 70% of startups fail in the first 3 years. And then you have to reflect on why. Because 100 years ago when businesses started, was it the same kind of failure rate? And I always reflect on what my dad always says. My dad was the latest adopter of technology in his businesses. I mean, I think until 3 or 4 years ago, we were still looking at manual ledgers. And he always says, like, I'm not going to let a laptop dictate how quickly I need to think. And he always reflected on, you know, back in the day when you had to make a major, like, investment decision, you'll receive the proposal, you'll go chat to your banker, you'll sleep on it for a couple of days. There was no rush to make decisions. And all of a sudden, we, like, in this constant rush to make decisions, and sometimes life-changing decisions that we need to make, you know, by the close of business. And is that actually serving us? And my hypothesis is no, it's not serving us. The reason we put ourselves under this kind of pressure to make critical decisions is because we're afraid somebody else is going to take the opportunity. So we're persistently working from this place of fear of competition, fear of the other, fear of the unknown. And that is not healthy for us from a spiritual perspective, right?
You know, you're touching on something so important, is this whole thing of emotional sovereignty. So on the podcast, I had an interview a while ago with Shannon McLachlan, and she's a neuro-emotional specialist, and she said something very profound. She said, you know, there's three states of mind that you have. You have your executive brain, your executive mindset, then you have your emotional state, and then you have your survival state of mind. Now, the survival state of mind is always fear, and it's reactionary, and it always needs to make a decision very, very quickly. But then you've got your emotional state, where it's all about your feelings, and you get very emotional, and you the survival state and emotional state play very, very much together, and can always put you back into survival state. And you can't make clear decisions when you're in those states of mind. You have to be in the executive brain. The challenge is that everybody that's sitting in boardrooms right now, making big decisions about our future, are doing it from a survival state of mind. They are not doing it from an executive state of mind. And this is why, if we want to be critical thinkers and we want to take on the challenges and the systems and the systemic issues that we are facing in this world, and I always say conscious leaders needs six intelligences in order to take on critical thinking. The first one is emotional intelligence. Next one is creative intelligence. You know, and I'm just going to say this very quickly, but when we were 5 years old, we were 95% more creative. We really have lost our creativity, and we need to go back to what we did as children in order for our creativity to come back. Then we also need to understand collective intelligence and how we are no longer smarter apart, but we are smarter together. We look at creative intelligence. Then we also need, obviously, the spiritual intelligence. But we also need to realize foresight intelligence is very important. Foresight intelligence, why are we leaving the future in the hands of a few futurists? Why can't we all accept the fact that we are all gifted to be futurists? And I feel in a lot of, you know, from the day we are born, we are always born with this fear of mindset of the end of the world happening, and this is going to happen, and that's going to happen. A future has been sold to us that we didn't sign up to. And we need to come together to say, are we going to change that future, or are we just going to accept the future that's being sold to us? Can we not do something to bring about change in this, what we're seeing?
So, yeah, it's like, are we going to participate in this future that's been created for us? Are we going to change it, or are we going to just perpetuate it? Because also, like, as parents, we tend to perpetuate the same messaging that we received while we were being parented, right? You need to study hard, you need to go to school, you need to go to university, you need to do the things. But how does that then change the world? How does that then change the reality? Mm-hmm. And there's like a lot of sort of acknowledging we need to do in this generational space that we're kind of living in, especially around how we interact with the world, how we interact with education, how we interact with the economy. Because, like you said, we've inherited this thing. This thing doesn't serve us. Are we going to force our kids to also inherit this thing in this fashion?
So true. You know, as I said to everybody, like, I was diagnosed, you know, being a neurodivergent or a neurodivergent individual. And, you know, I'm starting to learn so much about the neurodiversity and what it means to me. Going through menopause, obviously, it amplifies it. But the reason I'm sharing that is that I'm finding these research studies that are also showing how neurodiversity is also amplified by us always being busy, always being online. They call it digital dyslexia, for example, where people are actually becoming dyslexic because of being online. And I think, like, if I look at everything that we've been talking about and where we are going, I feel that in order to solve the future, I think the key is in balance.
Yeah, so definitely balance, definitely understanding where we are. So, I mean, you talked a little bit about the midlife crisis, and I can confidently say that I'm firmly embedded in a midlife crisis. Like, I'm in it. I'm making my life decisions. But the first thing that happens, especially as women, I think, or what happened for me, and I'm not going to generalize this one, is that I started reflecting on the decisions that I've made throughout my life and wondering how many of those decisions were actually my decision versus, you know, I decided something because that's what, you know, society told me to do, or my teachers told me to do, or my parents expected of me, or my children expected of me, and then my husband expected of me. Like, so how many of the decisions that have framed my life to this point were actually my decision? And if I were to go back and make those decisions as me, for me, what would be different? Right. And I feel like, I mean, obviously we all reflect our own nonsense to everybody else that we encounter and see, but what we're doing now, what that process has done for me is it's allowed me to engage my clients and the communities that we serve in a different way by asking that question. Like, so, you know, we run a couple of bursary programs. And so when I'm interviewing the applicants now, I ask the question, like, do you want to study law because you want to study law? Or do you want to study law because your parent or Nelson Mandela studied law? And once you start peeling off those layers, you get to the root of, you know, what people want to study, what they want to achieve, what their dreams are, and what motivates them. And increasingly, I find that it's not necessarily wealth, money, assets that motivate people. It's more about a quality of life. It's more about acceptance. It's more about acknowledging their own identity. And not just at a grassroots personal level, but also like at a corporate level. You know, when you speak to the executives independently, everybody kind of wants the same thing. They want their kids to be secure. You know, they want, you know, every parent wants their kid to have a better experience of the world than what they did. They want to leave an element of security. A lot of executives are very paternal, so they want the similar experience for their staff. Intrinsically, no person in any sort of leadership position is fundamentally bad. Nobody's going to outright say, you know, I want my staff to work until they die and have heart attacks at their desk. It's not something as a human, once you get to the human layer, that's going to be articulated or come out. But there's definitely a disconnect between who we are authentically and then how we show up in the world and the decisions that we make and, you know, how we behave.
I absolutely love that. I mean, I say this to you a million times. Like, in this world of artificial intelligence, I believe that the universe constitutes out of two opposites. So the North Pole, South Pole, East and West. And then we've got inwards, outwards, you know, negative, positive, you name it. The same as with artificial intelligence is authentic intelligence. It's the soft skills. It's the who we are as human beings. Adriana Marais says it's so beautiful. For once, can we stop hiding from each other and just look each other in the eyes? Have you ever tried doing that exercise where you look in somebody in the eye for a minute or 2 minutes? You release a hormone called oxytocin, and oxytocin is the same chemical that gets released when a mother starts breastfeeding, and it builds a connection. And when we look each other in the eyes, we form connection, but we have gotten to a place where we can't look each other in the eyes anymore. And if we get back that to that part, maybe together we can create a future that we want and not be in a position where we are making decisions for a future we don't want. I don't know if you come across this, but so many people, and I see it so much through ethnography, where people go, oh, you know what? They're predicting there won't be water in 50 years. At least I'm not here in 50 years. You know, it's that mentality of it's not my problem. They must sort it out. And I think that's the problem, is we can no longer think like that.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. I think that we all have to acknowledge our part in the problem. We also all have to acknowledge the fact that it's going to take some work and effort to turn the ship around.
Yeah, totally. Well, this is just a taster of what's to come. For those of you that are here, we've got some questions. I'm not going to pose them now, but if you have more questions, just put them in the Q&A for us. But one of the things that I would like to encourage all of you that are here is bring your colleagues along, invite people, share it, that we can bring more people, that we can have these conversations together, and we can try and see what impact we can have and what we can build from these this ESG webinar series that we're doing. We are just taking a leap of faith, and we are what build the ark and they will come. And hopefully, you know, we can spread the word of the change that we want to see in the world that can start right here in this little community. What I want to say is, Kanisa, thank you so much for always supporting us and always being there. She also serves on our advisory board for Conscious Leaders. So thank you so much. She's asked a very interesting question. She said, would you say South Africa requires more attention on the S&G given the high inequality and social challenges?
So yes, and I don't think it's just South Africa. I think it's the global South in general. But let's talk about Africa as a continent for a second. The environmental kind of cause, the climate change, the sort of environmental cause is very much a narrative driven by the global north. So we're very, very focused on carbon emissions and carbon offset and adaptation and mitigation strategies from a carbon emissions perspective, generally in the ESG conversation. And that's very much a narrative driven by the global north, right? Especially because if you consider the total volume of carbon emissions from Africa every year, it's about 4% of total emissions. So even if, as a continent, we were able to achieve net zero by 2050, which is what everybody wants us to achieve, it's like a pimple worth of an achievement. I mean, the other polluters in the world are still driving the sort of net carbon emissions. It's not going to make much of a difference in the whole sort of landscape. At the same time, we have to contemplate, and I always encourage everybody to contemplate, well, like, why is that the narrative? Why is that the key driver? And what does controlling our carbon emissions do in our context? It avoids us exploiting the coal resources that we do have. It exploits us exploring for additional coal and gas reserves, which do exist off our coasts. It avoids us industrializing on the back of this fossil fuels, untapped fossil fuels. So it avoids us going on an industrial pathway that has enabled the economic diversification of the global north, right? So who does that serve? And that's, I don't have an answer to that question. I'm just going to put a pin in that. From an S&G perspective, governance is obviously a huge challenge from a public sector and a private sector perspective on our continent. We have crises of leadership everywhere. And can that problem be solved by embarking on a new reporting framework? By complying to a new scorecard? I don't think so. That's a human problem that needs to be solved. That definitely needs to be solved at a societal level, right? But again, we see that those leadership crises are not unique to Africa. They're not unique to the global south. We see crises of leadership all around the world. I mean, what's going on in the UK again, what's going on in the US is shocking. So who do we look to for leadership role modeling and governance role modeling? And are we going to treat governance and leadership as this tick box exercise that most of these frameworks and scorecards end up being? And I think that is an introspective question that we need to answer. From an S perspective, surprisingly in South Africa, especially internal social dynamics within organizations, we still tend to do quite well compared to the rest of the world. I think, and I've said this to Carmen a lot, I think that we don't give ourselves credit where it's due. And I think from that perspective, because of the robust regulatory environment in South Africa, companies that have elected to comply with like the BEE codes authentically, companies that have embedded employment equity practices into the mechanisms and are complying with the Skills Development Act are faring really well in terms of of social well-being internally in the organization. I think we can do better in terms of how organizations interact externally with society. And that goes back to the marketing conversation. It goes back to elevating CSI or SED activities and acknowledging the beneficiaries as humans rather than, you know, numbers, impact numbers. And really, really targeting contributions in a way that affects sustainable change and elevation of the beneficiaries. Because what's happened? What's happened as a result of our increased focus on transformation over the last 20 years is that beneficiaries of corporate social initiatives, socioeconomic development initiatives, have received a lot, but there hasn't been a lot of development. And we ask ourselves why. And the hypothesis on the street is that we actually enjoy beneficiaries staying where they are. We calculated that over the last 20 years, there's been enough money spent in socioeconomic development activities. I mean, there's always opportunity cost to everything, but there's been enough money spent in socioeconomic development to completely privatize the entire Department of Education.
Sure.
Right? And privatize the entire education system in South Africa and make private education level education available for all South African children going through the system. That's how much money is being spent. But then if we interrogate how that money is being spent, as much as companies make these enormous contributions, they probably spend double on their marketing around those contributions and public relations and press releases and beautiful videos and things like that. So then it speaks to the intentionality around their social investments, right?
Sure. You know, just touching on to this conversation, you know, I think Kalnisha and I, you know, I remember the day I met her, I became like overwhelmed with like tears and stuff because I'm just like, I love what I do so much. I belong here. And I'm just like, and Kalnisha, you know, you've just shared so much wisdom with me and you've really taken me under your wing. And helping me also see the world of sustainability in such a different light. I think what I honestly can say to you is that, you know, the cakey thing that you were talking about, the makeup in the beginning, is I've been rappelling against the marketing industry. I'm like a marketing activist out there. I sometimes ruffle the feathers of the industry. Because I feel that there is not enough understanding, you know, and this is my personal point of view. So many times when I go and see a client, when I'm alone with that client, the mask comes off and then you get to understand who that person is. But then the moment the boardroom is full of people, that mask goes back up. And what that shows to me is that people are not feeling safe to bring their whole selves to the table. Now, if we want to solve the future, we need to bring everything about us, our whole selves, authentically. And authenticity, I think, is misunderstood as just showing up as who you are. No, authenticity and being an authentic leader means that you're doing the work, the inside work, to show transformation and inner growth and inner revolution work in order to impact what's going on in the outside of the world. And just to go back to my point, what I'm trying to make is in order for organizations to drive an impact, we need to look at the whole, all the parties need to come to the table now. We can't just have conversations in our boardrooms, and we need to bring the supply chain in. We need to talk about entrepreneurship, because in 4 years, 3-4 years, 40 or 50% of the world is going to be entrepreneurs, and we need to start preparing for that. What is our BE structures looking like? How are we going to drive more inclusivity there? Are we preparing for that? Because that in entrepreneurship, if we just look at what's happening in the tech world, hacking, the people that gets hacked the most is entrepreneurs. And when you hack an entrepreneur, their entire livelihood falls apart, and then some of them have to close their businesses. So, you know, there's so many of this world that we are creating and that we're forcing on people, we also need to see what the impact is on all of those around, and looking at the whole picture, looking at the supply chain, but also looking at, you know, how I think, Kanisha, you also mentioned this some time ago, but if we look at the emissions that comes from technology alone, is more than a whole country's airports in a day. I mean, like, it's insane, but nobody talks about that. And that's where we need to find that balance, you know, maybe go and sit under a tree for half a day without computers while you work on your creative intelligence.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing what we don't talk about. So we don't talk about emissions from technology. We don't talk about the resources inside the technology and how that technology was, how those resources were mined and who was exploited in the process. We don't talk about how everything originates on this continent, but we aren't getting any wealthier collectively. So there's a lot that we do need to talk about.
There is, and you know what, like, the one thing about marketing is all about managing perception. My husband always says to me, if you want to define marketing is about managing perception. And that's the scary thing, is because the whole world is now marketers. Technology has democratized marketing. Everybody's doing marketing and learning the most terrible marketing techniques from the industry at the moment. But this is what excites me. If marketing was the thing that contributed a lot to unsustainability, it is perhaps the thing that can also save our planet. And it's looking, for example, if you have a spider bite by a black widow spider, you need that venom in order to save your life. So the problem is with the solution is also in the problem. And yin and yang, they say there's good and there's bad, and there's good in the bad and there's bad in the good. And that ultimately is balance. And that's what we need to achieve. So any closing thoughts from you, Kalnisha?
I'm very, very excited that we are having these conversations. I think that one way to really affect change in our global society is to influence the conversations that are being had at dinner. And I hope that we have managed to spark some sort.
Absolutely. I feel, and you know what, I'm glad it was an intimate group in the end, because, you know, I feel like we had a very open conversation, and we want to continue this open conversations. So there's a lot of webinars releasing. We've only started. We're just going to go with the flow. We're building this arc. So just follow Conscious Leaders. You can follow Kalnisha on LinkedIn, on our social media platforms. You can find me there. And yeah, I just want to send you all love, and I want to say thank you for everybody for joining, and yeah, also listening to the podcast. There's some interesting things where we're talking with women of resilience, using pain to fortify yourself and build trust within yourself, because we need to bring intuition back. We need to make intuition a cool thing again. Anyway, thank you everybody. Please, thank you so much for coming today. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.